to play De Colores. I forgot while I was putting together today's service that this is, of course, Cinco de Mayo. Very, very important holiday, especially for Mexican Americans. I understand not so big in Mexico. And of course, it's not Mexican Independence Day. This isn't the 4th of July, but this does celebrate the victory of the Mexican people over French, who had come to impose French imperial rule on them, disrupting their steady course toward the nation they are today. So that's the reason for the celebration. So many things. If you listen to our music, you've probably heard so many sounds from so many different parts of the world. Our Rise Up, O Flame has the little flavor of the East in it. And this is a church that has its oldest origins in the East. Our very oldest origins are in Egypt. Anyone from Egypt here today? Some of the very earliest church fathers who were adopting a Unitarian point of view were in Egypt. But today we're going to be talking, we're coming up into Europe and talking a little bit more about the East European origins. Well, I have a morning reading. I don't do many New Testament-based readings here because that book comes loaded with so many issues for us. It's the scripture of the majority religion in our country. And within that majority, there's always a vocal minority who would like to make it everyone's religion. If not by law, then by hook or by crook or social pressure. Conversions of others sometimes seems more important to many of these folks than practicing this religion themselves. They actively try to hook as many as they can, taking Jesus' words about making his disciples fishers of men literally, I guess. But after too much hook and crook, we may hesitate to explore the riches of the New Testament. And that's a shame, because its riches are many. The story it tells is sad and strong and sorrowful and stirring and filled not with facts, but with human truth, powerfully told, like we find in this scene. Jesus went with his disciples to a place called Gethsemane. And he said to them, "Sit here while I go yonder and pray." And taking with him Peter and two sons of Zebedee, he began to be sorrowful and troubled. Then he said to them, "My soul is very sorrowful, even to death. Remain here and watch with me." And going a little farther, he fell on his face and prayed, "My Father, if it's possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as thou wilt." He wants out from a situation that's been closing in on him, backed by the power of civil and religious authority. He's glad that at least he still has his friends to watch his back until he looks that way and finds that they're asleep. He shakes them up. He goes to pray once more, returns, and again they're sawing logs. He's supposed to be the carpenter, not them. And then it happens a third time. And now he says, "Are you still sleeping and taking your rest? Behold, the hour is at hand, and the Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Rise, let's be going. See, my betrayer is at hand." While he was still speaking, Judas came, one of his main disciples, and with him a great crowd with swords and clubs sent by the chief priests and elders of the people. Now the betrayer had given them a sign, saying, "The one I shall kiss is the man. Seize him." And he came up to Jesus at once and said, "Hail, Master!" And he kissed him. Jesus said to him, "Friend, why are you here?" He smelled something was wrong. Well, that's a kiss and a question that's worth spending some more time with after we sing. Let's rise in body or spirit and sing together hymn number 134, "Our World is One World." I love the sort of glad yearning and the confidence of that hymn. It's a beautiful hymn. Well, hail, Master. Friend, why are you here? In the Gospel of Matthew, these words and that kiss from Judas are the very last contact that Jesus will have with any of his disciples before his death. Contact with Judas, not Peter or one of the other nice ones. The story continues. Then they came up and laid hands on Jesus and seized him. And behold, one of those who were with Jesus stretched out his hand, drew his sword, and struck the slave of the high priest and cut off his ear. Then Jesus said to him, "Put your sword back in its place, for all who take the sword will perish by the sword. Do you think that I cannot appeal to my Father, and he will at once send me more than 12 legions of angels? But then, how should the scriptures be fulfilled that it must be so?" I'm a little suspicious of that last passage. I think it might have been added to show that Jesus is ultimately in control of the whole situation. These events have been predicted after all, but I felt in his earlier words, "Friend, why are you here?" A note of real surprise and even shock. Maybe there's a tragicomic edge in his voice now as reality sets in, yet he boasts that he could call for a dozen legions of angels or even more. If they're legionnaires, would they be dressed like Roman soldiers with those helmets and shields and the whole bit? So maybe Jesus is mocking Judas with this graphic image of God sending in his band of armed supporters saying, "Hey, look, mine's bigger than yours." Maybe Judas was always his joking buddy among the disciples, unlike Peter, who was always just too earnest and who's about to run away along with all the rest. Judas is the only one to stay. He's still there. And Jesus gives it to him in front of everyone, just like Judas had given Jesus that kiss. It's the first Judas kiss that we can call by that name, but hardly the last. Francis David and Giorgio Biandrata were also good friends. Back in the 1500s in Transylvania, where the first Unitarian churches to use that name were soon to be established, Francis David, or David Ferenc in the Hungarian usage, it's backwards to ours, your first name comes last, was the intellectually gifted son of a shoemaker. He first attended Catholic seminary and became the rector of a Catholic school. He then embraced the Reformation and went on to become the superintendent of all Hungarian Lutheran churches. Later, after further study and revision of his views, he became superintendent of the rival Calvinist Reformed churches. And he eventually became the first Unitarian minister in the world and bishop of all the Unitarian churches that had formed during this final stage of his career. He also died as the first truly Unitarian martyr. Who knows how much of this would have happened, though, if not for his friendship with Biandrata. Biandrata had come from Italy, studied medicine in France, then made his way across Europe as the personal physician to a number of noble families, specializing in what were called the nervous disorders of women. I guess men didn't have nervous disorders back then. He was fascinated by religious questions and had spent time in Geneva, where John Calvin had established himself as something like the Ayatollah of a Protestant theocratic state. Calvin mistrusted his probing mind and wrote of him as, quote, "a treacherous troublemaker, a barbarian, a beast, and a dirty dog." Like it is so often with Calvin, you can just feel the Christian love. In Transylvania, Biandrata was attached to the noble Bathory family and thereby gained influence in the court of King John Sigismund. Getting to know Francis David as a Reformed church leader, he helped set him up as the king's court preacher. Eventually, under the influence of these men, Sigismund would become the first, last, and only Unitarian king in history. But that's a story for another day. Biandrata had cultivated relationships with many leaders of the Reformation, but he developed a special closeness with David. Together, they began to probe Orthodox Christian doctrines, taking their inquiries beyond anything that Luther or Calvin had ever attempted, and far beyond what they would have allowed. Biandrata was always pushing David to go still further. He was the one egging him on. Well, Europe at the time had been going through a communications revolution not unlike the one we've been experiencing these past few years. Before the widespread use of paper and the invention of the printing press, books had been rare and few and extremely expensive. A whole herd of sheep was required to provide the vellum for just one copy of a hand-lettered Bible, and that was reflected in the cost. The sharp rise in the availability of books and the spread of literacy went hand in hand with earth-shaking results, especially in people's religious lives. With their own Bibles in their hands for the first time, more and more people could question the teaching of the church, come to their own conclusions, and then write books of their own to share with others. When church or civil authorities objected to a book, they might attempt to seize and destroy all the copies. But this became increasingly difficult with their decreasing size. A folio book might be bigger than a desktop computer, way more. But the quarto was much smaller. The octavo, duodecimo, and sextodecimo were smaller still, corresponding to the laptop, iPad, and smartphones of our time. How could you find and destroy all of them? You could find and destroy a printing press, that's true. Or you could just try to destroy the author. But even if you did that, the books would still be out there. People watching this unfolding drama of ideas, information, and power were fascinated. One historian of the time wrote that public debates of important questions were as popular as tournaments and jousts had formerly been, and no subjects had a more lively appeal than those of religion. Such debates could as easily end in death as those earlier forms of entertainment, and this may have added to their appeal. People like that kind of stuff. Torture and prison were also likely outcomes for those who lost the debates or offended the wrong people while winning them. It was in such a setting that Biandrata and David began to question the doctrine of the Trinity, God in the three distinct persons of Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. At first they were cautious. They presented arguments for and against this central teaching of the church. But over time, they became bolder. They became bolder still when they were given their own printing press by the king himself. Not a bad person to have for your friend. One of the first projects for which they employed this new technological wonder was a book called The False and True Knowledge of God. It was devoted mostly to serious and sober arguments of scriptural verses and ecclesiastical teachings about the nature of God. But it also included one chapter that was illustrated with representations of the Trinity that was still affirmed on both sides of the Catholic and Protestant divide. Well, these pictures in the book included a three-faced figure installed on an altar, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit sitting at a table or being transformed into a communion wafer. And there was a picture of the actual flesh of Christ descending from heaven. I don't know if it looked like a coat or what it looked like. But it's important to note that David and Biandrata had created none of these images themselves. They were all from perfectly orthodox sources like church sculptures or tapestries from different parts of Europe. The new medium of printing made it possible to bring all of them together, accompanied by the questions in a critical text. And as is so often the case, the graphics got the most attention from the offended Orthodox believers who felt that their noses were being rubbed in something that they themselves had produced. That is no fun to experience. Although I think that the two friends had fun with the book. I can imagine them talking to each other. Can you believe that those guys believe in this? But understand that Biandrata and David were not doing this just for the pleasure of argument or to be contrarian. They acted out of concern for salvation and the fear that such religious concepts as God in three persons put every unsuspecting believer in danger of punishment for the sin of idolatry. And at the same time, I do think they had fun doing it. It can be very exciting for friends to face some danger together, especially if they feel that they've got a king in their corner and at least some measure of power. Well, there was a big storm about those illustrations, but they weathered it. And then at Biandrata's urging, David entered and won several important theological debates, including one at the city of Varat, where, true to his name David, he bested several well-known Goliaths in religious matters. He then boldly proclaimed, "Ed Yosh Ishtein," God is one, while he was standing on a boulder in the city of Koloshvar. And he was carried on the shoulders of a cheering crowd to his church, where he continued the sermon. Many churches then throughout the city and the region were soon openly Unitarian in theology. Ed Yosh Ishtein was written over many doors and pulpits, proclaiming a new freedom of inquiry and full liberty to study and interpret the scriptures according to one's own conscience. Sounds great, doesn't it? The new era of toleration. We're often fooled into thinking that everything's changed. 2 years later, King John Sigismund was dead. Transylvania had a new prince, and things changed in the courts of power. Through his role as a physician, Biandrata smoothly insinuated himself into the new ruler's good graces. I guess that the women in the new ruler's family had nervous disorders for him to treat. But meanwhile, David was denied a place at court, and he was now without access to a printing press. But even so, he began in his own church to ask ever more challenging questions. Whether Christ, since he was not called God by the apostles, could positively be called God. And if not, whether he could be invoked in prayers. Could we ask Jesus to help us or save us? Does Jesus save, like highway signs still say today? David said, no. We have to ask God alone for that. Biandrata thought David was going too far and urged him to recant. Go get you the printing press. You can publish a recant of recall your statements. But he was worried that such extreme views could put all Unitarian churches, their ministers, and their members at risk. It was a legitimate concern, as we'll see in the next sermon, to see what happened to the lay people. But no doubt he was also worried about the well-being and the livelihood of one Giorgio Biandrata, who had grown accustomed to the pleasures of high society and now felt exposed and vulnerable. David responded to this by going even further and proclaimed that Jesus should not be worshipped as God. That's an easy thing to say. Did you feel the heaven shake or the building shake? But in those days, that was something to say in Europe. And now Biandrata denounced him to the prince, who had David put under arrest, house arrest at this time, and forbade him to speak in any church. But before beginning his confinement, David preached one final sermon, which ended like this: "Whatever the world may yet try to do, it will nevertheless become clear to the whole world that God is one. Ed Yosh Ishtein." Shortly thereafter, at Biandrata's urging, the prince had a council convened to put David on trial. Social class played a role. The shoemaker's son was to be judged by a panel of hereditary nobles whose interests were vested more in order and power than in truth or conscience. Biandrata took the role of chief prosecutor and attacked David on the grounds that by teaching us to worship God alone, he was essentially preaching a conversion to Judaism. He didn't say, dare say Islam, because he might have been nervous about the Ottoman Empire right next door. It's miles away. David replied by asking if Biandrata had not also held such views until recently. His friend replied at the trial that even if he once had, he no longer did so. Long arguments and testimony followed. David and his supporters were asked to leave the hall for a time while the panel deliberated. While they were out, Biandrata denied that he had ever shared David's views, which he now called no less than blasphemy. When David was called back into the room, Biandrata crossed the floor to, as they wrote, the chroniclers at the time wrote, to embrace him and reassure him that all would be well. It's not recorded if he kissed his old friend or not, but how could anyone present have failed to see Judas and Jesus in these two? It's bad enough to be brought to such a place by an enemy, but this was a friend. Making you feel like all will be okay when he has already made sure that it won't be. One of Biandrata's fellow prosecutors argued for the death penalty, while others pleaded for David's life. At any rate, the guilty verdict had been reached by the time of this embrace. David, who was already ill, was sentenced to life imprisonment in a castle dungeon where he died 5 months later. His burial place was kept a secret. That's a time-honored way to keep such graves from becoming rallying points or shrines, still practiced today. What about Giorgio Biandrata? He soon cut off relations with his former Unitarian colleagues and associated himself with Catholics, but most often kept to himself. Religious matters no longer held his interest, and he turned his efforts, we're told, to amassing as much money as possible. His nervous disorders paid well. Eventually, he named one of his nephews as the heir to his large fortune, on the surprising condition that the young man would remain Unitarian. Now, some people say that this nephew smothered the good doctor in his sleep in order to claim the inheritance early. The evidence is mixed. It seems that on one hand, Biandrata had abandoned his friend for comfort and wealth, but it seems that there was also part of him that stayed where he and his friend had done so much together. Imagine what that feels like. That must have been a terrible tension for him to bear. The Gospel of Matthew tells us that Judas returned the 30 pieces of silver he got for betraying Jesus, and then he hanged himself. That's one version. The book of Acts says that he used the money to buy himself a nice plot of land, but when he stepped onto it, he sort of exploded. The blast was supposed to be centered in his bowels. Not a happy ending. Not a happy story, and I'm not sure that I'd like to see this part depicted graphically. But speaking of graphics, did you see the cover of your order of service today? It shows the symbol of the Unitarian Churches of Transylvania, inspired by a line from that same Gospel of Matthew that's supposed to have been one of Francis David's favorites. Behold, I send you out as a sheep in the midst of wolves, so be as wise as serpents, see the serpent, and as innocent as doves, the dove in the center. Notice how the serpent seems to hold the dove within limits, but also notice how it's swallowing its own tail. Well, that could make your bowels explode big time. It's a powerful graphic, especially if you know that the next line tells us to, quote, beware of men, for they will deliver you up to councils. I don't know if the church adopted this symbol before or after the events I've shared with you today. What's your guess? Before or after? I can't find any record of it. It's a difficult thing to try to imagine. But friends, why are you here if not to think about such things sometimes? It's a difficult story. Sad and strong, sorrowful and stirring, but it's our story too. May we go forward today into the light of this beautiful May Day, knowing that our roots grew strong in what was sometimes real darkness. Blessed be.